And Wade Gershner back with you on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs, joined by a very special guest today. And we were thinking it'd be cool to do a series on various athletes from North Central Kansas that have gone on, done really good things at the next level, whether it be college or the pros. And of course, we've had Bailey Brown on, Jenna Ferris, Vanessa Kersine, Austin Butkus, who's now playing at K-State, and then others over the last few years that have played at the next level. And we're going to be trying to get a hold of some of those other folks here in the weeks and months ahead. And today we're joined by Scott Fulhage, who you may have heard of him. He punted in the National Football League and, of course, started right here in Beloit, Kansas. And Scott, good to have you with us today. How's everything going for you in your life after football?
Well, I guess it's probably not quite as exciting as what it used to be, but other than that, everything's going great. My kids are doing well. My wife's hanging right in there, and I got some grandkids now, so I get to have fun with them, and that makes it all worthwhile, that's for sure.
For people that don't know, what are you doing now? You're in your, what, early, mid-50s now?
Actually, I'm almost, I just turned 54, which okay. is hard to believe for me anyway, it seems like, but I'm back home farming on the farm. I always came back and farmed, even during when I was playing in the NFL. I would come back during the off season. It wasn't something that most guys didn't stick around mm-hmm. year round like they do now. So we'd fill up the U-Haul trailer and pack up the kids and the dog and the cat and travel all back home, and I'd farm during the summer and head back for training camp.
Is it kind of refreshing when you see the stories about Jordy Nelson? Kind of doing the same thing, isn't he?
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun to watch Jordy, too, other than his injury this year. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's Jordy being a farm kid, and, I've seen some articles with him running the combine and kind of brings back memories of some of the stuff that some of the farm magazines did when I was playing football, too, on farming So, Jordy's a class act, so, you always enjoy seeing things about him.
What were your goals? Like, for instance, my oldest son is 9 now, and he talks about how he's going to be a college football player. He's going to play football at one college, basketball at another. He's got it all figured out. He's going to be a professional, this or that. And odds are he probably won't. Not that I want to squash his dreams, but there's always that chance. And I think guys like you and Jordy Nelson and others give yourself hope. But what were your goals and aspirations when you were growing up, when you were 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, getting closer to high school? Did you have any thoughts of playing college ball or going to the pros?
I don't really think that I did back then because, we didn't have cable TV and
all the social
media.
Don't
even know if I ever watched a football game on TV or mm-hmm. Growing up or basketball game, we just didn't get the reception to pick anything like that up. So I just, I loved to play sports. And part of the, one way to get out of having to come home and work was to go out for sports. So maybe that encouraged mm-hmm. me to get involved in as much athletic endeavors as I could because I got out of work by going and doing the sports. But I really loved the game of football. It's just something that I could play it with my buddies, go out and play catch. I would kick the ball over the grain bins, over the house, as a kid growing up, kick the ball up in the air and catch punts. I never really thought that I would be a punter in college or in the pros. I just wanted to play the game. I wanted mm-hmm. to play linebacker, actually, or defensive back in college. So as far as setting goals for playing football, I'd say if you love it, just encourage them to play it and have a good time. And whatever happens is what happens. So and you got to work hard.
Talking to Scott Fulhage, a punter in the National Football League, is with the Bengals and the Falcons. Of course, at Beloit High, went to Kansas State. He's with us today on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs. When was your first competitive football game, was that junior high?
Yeah, it would have been junior high first tackle football game mm-hmm. against.
You didn't have all this flag football. This
no, we played
football.
A little bit of flag football, mm-hmm. but it was just against each other. Yeah. In grade school, so I was dying for junior high to get here so we could suit up and actually start playing real football. And that is the big difference today. You're not playing football and basketball at a young age all year round. Basically, you're. Mm-hmm. It seems like you're involved with something, And, you know, sometimes I don't know if that's good or bad. I think lots of times their bodies just need to grow and not be out there banging themselves around already at such a young age.
What positions did you play in junior high and then in high school? I'm guessing you didn't punt all the time and that was it, because you just said, I want to be a linebacker, defensive back. You want to tackle people. Obviously, as a punter, you're not tackling anybody unless they're returning a punt back for six.
Well, in junior high, I played quarterback and linebacker. And then same way in high school, I'd play quarterback and running back and linebacker. Probably linebacker was my favorite position. I really enjoyed, you know, getting in on tackles and hitting people. So that was probably the favorite thing for me to do. I punted because I could do it. I never dreamed of being able to get a scholarship from a major college just to punt the football. And I'm not sure, you know, one of the reasons I went to K-State was because they said I could play some defensive back, but then once I got there, they really had no intention of me doing that anyway.
They suckered you in.
Pretty much they did. So, you know, there's other options for me to go to just be a punter, but I thought I could do something else.
When did school start showing interest in you as a punter? Was it your junior year sooner, or was it senior year?
Well, I started getting some letters from teams my junior year, and then my senior year, at the end of the season, I was, no one had told me, but until they started recruiting me, that I was one of the top three punters in statistics in the country. And so then I started getting recruited by Michigan and K-State and KU, and those are the three bigger schools that recruited me. And Michigan had never offered a scholarship to a punter. So I was actually one of the first punters ever offered a scholarship by the University of Michigan. And I went up there, and I just couldn't make myself go that far away from home since I've been a K-State fan my whole life.
I figured there was a tie there and why you went to Kansas State. So let's proceed then to your college days. You go to Kansas State. What kind of adjustment was that for you? I mean, you're going from, I remember just me going from high school to college. I'm like, really? I can go to class, but I don't have to go to class? And I played a college sport, but it wasn't nearly as intense as football was, playing tennis at college. But, I mean, it was busy. I mean, you have to juggle your practice schedule with your homework or your classwork and this and that, make sure you're eligible. And then the freedom of being away from the family to where you can kind of do whatever you like to do. How did that go for you?
Well, actually, it went pretty good. I wasn't, you know, one of the smartest guys on the team, but I was a good student, and, you know, I had to study. But I think probably one of the things that helped me the most was I had pretty good roommates that you know, took their college seriously too. I didn't room with football players. I roomed with, well, H.J. Ackerman here in Beloit was one of my roommates. But those guys, you know, they were good students, and lots of times when I'd get home from practice, they were studying. So that helped out with me to put my nose in the book and get some of the things done that I needed to get done. But you know, it's a lot different now where they have the study tables, you know, and you got to spend so much time out there, and the coaches are kind of keeping better track of you now than they used to. So a lot of guys didn't go to class, and they didn't make it, you know, with their classes and stuff in their grades. But, you know, if you just show up and the teachers know you know that you're there and you're trying to show an interest in the class, most of the professors at K-State work with you on your game schedules, and so it's not that big of an issue, really, if you put a little bit of effort into it.
Talking to Scott Folhage, our guest today on a Sports Ticket brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs. So you were a punter at Kansas State, a starter all 4 years, correct?
Yeah, I was actually redshirted my freshman year. I broke my ankle at Concordia pole vaulting when I was a senior. So I got redshirted my first year at K-State, and then I punted 4 years after that.
And the speed of the game, obviously, is so much faster from high school to college. Did you have to work on how quickly you kicked the ball,
I mean, that was one thing that you know, you have to work at, you know, not taking as long. But the thing about it is, you know, you get guys that are snapping the ball to you more consistently. They can snap it faster. They can, you know, you get a good guy and you know it's where the ball is going to be every time. So that helps with your speed and your consistency. And so, you know, again, everything, you know, is better at the next level. Same, you know, it's also with the guys that are snapping the ball and the guys that are blocking for you up front. You know, they do a better job for the most part. So, you know, y'all, we spend a lot of time every day in practice working on special teams and blocking, and it just all kind of comes together.
What are the things that you worked on in practice? I think it's becoming more and more of a science as a punter. I watched Dustin Colquitt with the Chiefs, and he's not satisfied getting inside the 20 or even the 10. He's got that thing down to a science. For the Chiefs, it's one of their big reasons why they've been successful recently. Field position, that's so important, and I'm sure that the coaching staff had told you that you can really flip the field.
You know, and it's changed over the years. When I first started playing, you know, what we tried to do was actually punt the ball out of bounds inside the 20-yard line, so there would be no chance of a return. Well, then as my career progressed, probably the last 3 years, we started pooching the football, which was trying just to hang it as high as we could and, you know, make them catch it, maybe drop it, or have them have to make a decision on what they're going to do with my football. And if they let it go, by pooching it high in the air, our guys would have time to run down and get behind it and maybe stop it before it went into the end zone. And nowadays, you know, they're dropping the ball like Australian kickers do in the game of Australian football. And I'd never kicked the ball that way, but the way that they're dropping it, you know, they're able to control kind of the backspin on that football when it hits, and they're putting that ball right down inside the 5-yard line all the time. And it just takes a lot of practice. You know, when I was playing, I could drop that ball over on the numbers and out of bounds, you know, probably 8 out of 10 times just because I've done it 1,000 times.
Now, you were at Kansas State there. It would have been, what, 80?
I graduated in 80 from high school, so I was there from 80 to 85.
Now, who was your coaches when you were at Kansas State?
Jim Dickey was my coach when I was there. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you proceeded to go to the National Football League. How did that all work out from, and when did you start thinking, hey, there's a chance I could play in the big leagues?
Well, I was... I had a pretty good career in college, so I had a couple NFL teams showing interest in me. Thought actually I might get drafted by the Detroit Lions, and they didn't draft me. But I went up there for my first workout, and you know it's really tough to get your foot in the door in the NFL. And you know, they keep saying, well, you don't have experience, and I'm you keep hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, how am I ever supposed to get it if you don't right. bring me into camp? And so really the first time that I got to camp, Dad loaned me some money to buy an airline ticket, and I flew up to Washington, D.C., where there was a kicking tryout going on with the Washington Redskins. And there was about 30 punters and 40 field goal kickers there. And we each got 10 balls to punt, and that – whoever did the best, they dropped it down to the top 10, and then we each got 10 more and then dropped it down to the top 5, and then the 5 of us duked it out there with some different types of kicks, and came down to me and Joe Prokop, who ended up with the Jets, and I ended up making it to training camp then that year with the Washington Redskins. So that was kind of how I got my foot in the door.
And of course, you didn't end up punting for the Redskins,
no.
But that opened the door for you to end up with the Bengals, right?
And it did. I mean, I was competing against Jeff Hayes, who was the punter for the Redskins at that time, and some of the other guys that they had brought in. And I saw that I could compete with them and do just as well. And so that really encouraged me to keep pushing. So I got in a couple of preseason ball games with the Washington Redskins before I got released. I actually thought I was going to make the team, but I didn't. And then I started writing letters to the Cincinnati Bengals because their punter hadn't done that well. And they actually gave me a phone call the next year and invited me to training camp. And Mike Brown, the owner, actually read my letter and said that intrigued him enough to – say I'd like to see him come to camp. So that was one of the reasons I actually got into camp with Cincinnati. And then, you know, that's where I ended up making the team.
So if you never wrote that letter, like a lot of people are a little bit gun-shy with doing things like that. Like, well, I really like this gal, but she might say no. And if you would just ask her once, she might say yes and surprise you. You had the guts to write the letter because, honestly, you really had nothing to lose by doing
that. Well, I had nothing to lose. And I even there's a couple of times I even called the Denver Broncos on the phone and asked to speak to I can't even think of the head coach's name. Oh, Dan Reeves. Mm-hmm. And thinking that there's no way they're going to put Dan Reeves on the phone just from somebody calling the office. Next thing I know, Dan Reeves is on the phone. Then I'm stuttering around trying to figure out what I'm going to say to him because I really never expected him to get on the phone.
You probably expected, this is Dan Reeves' voicemail. All right, I got that all planned out. And then you talk to a live person. That's happened to me as well. We're talking to Scott Folhage, who's our guest today on the Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs. So take us through then. So you get the letter. You send the letter to Mike Brown. He contacts you. So then you're invited to camp. You obviously win the job then.
Well, it's another long story.
Okay, well, that's why we're here.
So that was actually the year of the strike.
Oh, boy.
And they had drafted another punter in the fifth round, Greg Horn out of Arizona. And Greg and I competed all through training camp, and it came down to the last football game, and we were playing against the Green Bay Packers. And Sam Weiss came up to me, to both of us, and said, whoever does the best in this ball game is who we're going to keep. And Greg got the first half, and he had a good first half. He had like a 44-yard average, was three punts. And then I got the second half, and I had two 51-yard punts, both of them out of bounds inside the five-yard line.
Sweet.
And so Greg and I were the last two guys to get notified who was going to be on the team on the last day of the cut. And I'm sitting there in the hotel room. Nobody calling. Then there's a knock on the door, and it's Greg Horn. And he goes, oh, sorry. And I'm like, about what? And he goes, oh, you haven't heard yet, but they're keeping me. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Great.
So I pack up the car, and I head home. But then the strike starts. They call me up, and I went back and played, you know, in the strike, and at the end of the strike, I was leading the NFL with a 47-yard average, and Sam Weiss again comes up to me the last ball game, and he says, if you do well in this game, we're probably going to keep you over Greg Horn. And I had a great game, had like eight or nine punts for 48-yard average, but then they released me again. So then I get picked up by Green Bay the next day, and I end up at Green Bay. I spend a couple weeks up there, and Greg Horn doesn't do well again during that two-week period, and Green Bay releases me, and Cincinnati picks me right back up. So I think Green Bay was just kind of helping Cincinnati out, holding me so nobody else could get me until they found out if Horn was going to pan out or not, and he never did.
So you learned at that point in time, and maybe you learned it before then, not to trust people. Because if Sam Weich is telling you, okay, if you perform better, whoever performs the best in this last game, and then you did, and then you're not even told by the coach, you're told by the competing punter that, oh, they chose me instead of you, next thing you know, you're packing up your stuff in the car.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of part of the life in the NFL until you finally get your foot in the door. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know how many teams I've had tryouts with. That's just, you know, a few, you know, that probably made the biggest difference on how I got into the NFL. But, you know, you're in and out. You have tryouts. You work out. People tell you one thing. You don't ever believe anything they tell you until it actually happens, really. And it's sad to say it that way, but it is really kind of true.
It's a business. So when you're trying out, what do they typically, are you just so many punts? Are you working on, you know, working on high punts, deep punts, angling out of bounds, inside the five? I mean, what do they have you do in a tryout?
Well, I mean, yeah, you do a variety of different things. Of course, they're timing every punt, and consistency is a big thing, too. You know, you don't want to go up there and hit one booming punt and then have five that aren't, you know, that aren't very good. So consistency and hang time are probably the two most important things. And then, of course, we go through, you know, most of the punters are the holders for the field goal kickers, too. So you go through a series of workouts holding the football with the snapper and you know, making sure that you can catch the football and place it, and, you know, and that you're going to be able to handle that for your kicker, too, because that's a big part of the kicker's success is having someone that they believe in, you know, that's going to catch the football. So you got to have really good hands if you're a punter, because you're catching, you know, 70, 80 snaps at 14 yards away with a guy that can snap the football as hard as a quarterback can can throw a football. So same way at 7 yards with field goals and extra points, you know, there's another 70-plus snaps, you know, a year that you're going to take that you can't drop. If you drop one, then, you know, if you drop two, you're probably going to be gone. So, you know, receivers get a second chance. Punters and holders don't very often. So you got to be perfect when you're catching the football.
So the Bengals made the Super Bowl in 89, and they played the 49ers. But you were not a member of that team, or were you?
That was in 80. Actually, that was in 88.
It was in 88?
Okay. Super Bowl 23.
Yeah, because it would have been technically the game would have played in 89, but it would have been the 88 season.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So in a Super Bowl 23. And, yes, I was on the team, but I had a back injury going into the playoffs. So I was there. I just didn't get to play in the game.
When Montana broke your hearts.
So, yeah. Well, how many times had that happened?
He did that to a lot of teams.
You know, one time it was my first year in Cincinnati, and, you know, after the strike and everything was over with, and I'm trying to, you know, get to know everybody, and I'm running on the field to punt out of the end zone against the 49ers, and there's only like a minute left in the game, and we're actually 4 points up in that ball game, and Brian Blados, who at the time one of the biggest guys in the NFL, he's, you know, 6'7", 340 pounds. I go running by him. He grabs me on the shirt and literally picks me up off the ground and looks at me and says, "Don't you screw this up, Fullhaig." And I'll let you imagine what words he actually used.
Yeah, sure.
But so there, you know, there's definitely some pressure involved in being the punter.
Man, you could be very you were very close to having a Super Bowl ring. So close. I'm a Super Bowl ring, and Montana on that last drive, I'm sure that, you know, hurt that team, and you just don't know if you're going to get back or not, and obviously they did not.
Yeah, and you know, that story I was telling you about back to Montana, it was a good punt, so I didn't mess anything up, but he put together a drive on that game and ended up beating us in the last few seconds, just like he did in the Super Bowl. I'll never forget Boomer Esiason was walking up and down the sidelines and talking about how he was getting ready to go to Disneyland, because that's what Super Bowl quarterbacks always did back then, you know. And he was all, everybody's laughing, and we were celebrating and having a good time. And next thing you know, Joe Montana does it again.
So close. So close. Well, you mentioned the strike, and it's interesting because a lot of people say a strike was a horrible thing. For any professional sport, it's not necessarily a good thing, but I'm sure you've wondered, what if the strike didn't happen? Would you have even had your chance, and would you have even played in the league for six seasons?
Yeah, you know, I have no idea. I mean, again, it goes back to, everybody always would tell me, well, you don't have any experience. Well, there was only one way I was going to get experience at that time, and that was to play when they said, you want to come back and play during the strike. And it was a really, it was stressful. I mean, you know, players on, you know, were lined up outside, you know, picketing and, you know, hollering and holding up signs. And then they'd be back at the hotel in downtown Cincinnati doing the same thing. So thing about it is, I got along really good with all the guys on the team. And, you know, all of them knew that really that I had done as well or better than the guy that they kept. And most of them thought that it should have been me to start with. So once it all worked itself out, there really wasn't any hard feelings with anybody. So I think everybody understands that, you know, you take advantage of your opportunity, and that was mine at the time.
Absolutely. Scott Fullhaig is our guest today on the Sports Ticket. So the Bengals' career ends there, and then you move on to the Atlanta Falcons. How did that all transpire?
Well, Atlanta's punter just was having kind of a rough, had a rough year, and preseason it wasn't going well for him. And then when I got released, Atlanta called me. I went down for like 2 weeks there with preseason left. I think there was two games, and punted well, and they just went ahead and went with me, and so ended up having, 5 years down in Atlanta then. With the Falcons, with Jerry Glanville, was a head coach my third year there, and that was exciting. I mean, he was kind of a fun guy to be around.
Well, I was going to ask you about him. I've heard other people that have played for Jerry Glanville said he was the most unique and oddest coach they'd ever played for, but they enjoyed playing for him.
And, you know, he would have his rules. Everybody thought he was kind of a loose cannon, and I guess maybe he kind of was, some of the things that he would say, but He had rules, and if you followed his rules, you get along with him. And if you broke the rules, curfew, late to practice, then you got on his list. And until you proved yourself, you know, different, and he knew you were sorry for the mistake you made, you're on his list.
Mm-hmm.
And if you never apologized or didn't put in the effort, you know, to make up for it, then he'd find a way to get you off the team. So
you play with obviously a lot of talent. We have to when you're on a team that makes it to the Super Bowl with Cincinnati and then the Falcons. And there was certainly a guy named Primetime Deion Neon Sanders, who very flamboyant. Sometimes athletes have a persona on the field and off the field. They're completely different. Was he like that, or was he what he was on the field, off the field?
Well, in some ways he was the same, I guess. I mean, he had a different car for each day of the week.
That must be nice.
You know, and he had talking alarms on his cars back when nobody else had alarms on their cars, you know. But he was probably one of the best teammates a guy could ever have. I mean, Deion always worked hard at practice, and he always gave it all in a ball game, and he was always one of the first ones to come up to you and tell you that you get a good job. And so I really liked him as a teammate. He really was a good teammate. If some guys were jealous of him, it was because he was just making more money than them. And so if there was hard feelings, it was more from that than anything else, I suppose. But he was a good guy. He really was.
Were you on one-year contract year after year, or did you have a long-term contract at one point, a multi-year deal, I should say?
Yeah, I had like a three-year deal. Would have been my longest contract with the Falcons.
With the Falcons?
Mm-hmm.
And now you probably see what guys are making for 3 years and go, wow, I was during the wrong era, right?
Well, yeah. It's unbelievable, really, what they're making or what the coaches are making. I mean, it's really escalated, you know. But, back when I was playing, it was still pretty good back then. To the salaries and stuff. And when I was at Cincinnati, actually, I remember Boomer Esiason signed the first $1 million contract of any player in the NFL.
Wow.
Back in, it probably would have been like in 87. So that kind of gives you an idea of where it's going now.
What was the first thing that you purchased once you got at least some security or stability with a multi-year deal?
Oh, I bought a new van just to it was a customized van, you know, room for the family to travel back and forth. So that was the first thing I actually spent some money on.
And then where did you meet your wife at?
At K-State.
At K-State. Okay. Yeah. So she was with you during this whole professional career.
Right.
With the Bengals. She had to move around and, you know.
Oh, yeah. 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 We moved, I think in my career, we moved 23 different times, different apartments, and then back to Beloit and then to different apartments. We finally purchased a house in Atlanta, so we had a home there for 3 years, and which worked out nice. But she was my long snapper. That's who went to practice with me too. The kids would just run around. She threw thousands of balls to me when we were out practicing.
Now, tell us how the career ended. Atlanta was your last team you played with. You had the Bengals in Atlanta, 92, I think it was your last season in the NFL.
Yeah.
How did that, was it one of those things where you knew the end was near and that you're probably, that was it? Or did you sit here and go, hey, I want to try on with other teams? Did you try for other teams? How did that all end for you?
Well, I ended up with a really bad injury in my groin and on my right leg. So I really wasn't able to punt that year. It was during training camp that I hurt myself. All of a sudden they called, it was a cold morning and they called punt team and we hadn't really stretched or worked out. We weren't supposed to have it that day. And I went out there and kicked and pulled that muscle. But that took a long time to heal up. And I ended up not playing that season. I trained hard and had tryouts with the Chiefs, with the Carolina Panthers, with the New York Jets. Thought that maybe I was going to catch back on with one of those teams, and it never did happen. And then I was, 33 years old or something at the time, and my leg, I was still could do pretty good, but I could tell it just wasn't the same after I pulled that muscle, and then it just never did quite work out for me again.
Any fake punts in your NFL career?
Oh, yeah. I threw threw once for 15 yards for first down, and then I think that was against the Redskins in Atlanta, and then I threw one against the Houston Oilers in Cincinnati for 70 yards for a touchdown, but then it got called back for a holding penalty.
Ah.
So that kind of sucked. And then another one I threw for a first down, the guy got pass interference on, and never ran for a first down. Those guys are just way too much too fast for me to ever get around the corner.
Mm-hmm. You probably didn't want to run for a first
not
down.
Not really. Yeah. I mean, you know, so we didn't really do a lot of fake punting. You know, Jerry Glanville, you know, he hardly ever ran fake punts. He said, you know, as long as I got a kicker that can kick field goals and a punter that can punt, as long as they do their job, there's no reason that we should have to run any fakes. So mm-hmm. that was kind of his philosophy. And I think when he was coaching, I don't know that we ever ran any fakes during the kicking game.
So based on what you told me, you have a 100% completion percentage in the National Football League.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
100%.
I'd be top of the all-time leaders board if they didn't have a minimum of so many attempts. Darn it. You were so close.
I know it.
What could have been, right? Of course, football runs in the family. I mean, you know, DJ punted at Beloit in Kansas State. Was that something? I mean, you mentioned your kids are with you and traveled and this and that. I would think that wore off on them, and they said, "Wow, Dad does this. This is pretty cool. I'd like to do that."
Yeah, you know, I think DJ was kind of like me when he first started his career. I think he would have liked to have played other positions too.
Mm-hmm.
He punted because he could punt, you know. And there is some. You know, you got to have some natural abilities to kick the football. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not something, you know, that you can just say, "Hey, I want to do this," and learn how to do it. If you can already go out there and when you're messing around and kick the football decently, then you can get better at it and learn some new techniques. But if you don't have that natural ability to kind of kick a ball like that, then it's really hard to learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But DJ had that natural ability. I mean, he had the same leg swing and you know, he probably wasn't as big as me, so maybe not as strong you know, to take him to the next level, because you know, most of the guys that are punting today are, you know, 6'1", 6'2". They're big guys. It's just like every other position, everybody seems to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, and stronger, and I think they probably kicked the ball a little further than what we did when I was playing overall.
What was your playing weight in the
181.
181.
Yeah. That's what I went to camp at almost every year, and I was usually up to about 190 by the end of the season. And then before I got serious during the summer, I was probably close to 200 again before I started working out again. So it could fluctuate pretty easily.
I would certainly, I'm sure you're proud of DJ and what he accomplished and all your children, but for your parents, I mean, you mentioned your dad loaned you money so you could go to a tryout in Washington. Without that, who knows where maybe you never play in the National Football League. You have to have support from your family, and just talk, I'm sure they were very proud of what you're able to accomplish.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they were too. I mean, I was proud of DJ. You know, we went to every game, you know, when he was playing. I don't know that we missed a game. Same way with my parents. I don't know that, you know, unless it was just really far away, they drove to every ball game and they had a lot of fun doing it. So it was a blast, you know, following DJ around. And I know my parents had fun following me around. But, you know, that definitely makes a big difference because there's a lot of stress, you know, to mm-hmm. it, you know, trying to go to school and spending, you know, 4 to 5 hours a day, every day at the football field, you know, which you know, does make it hard to stay up on your studies or not even really want to study.
Mm-hmm.
Because lots of times you get back, you know, to your dorm room or whatever, and everybody's already done studying, and then you get back and it's time to study. So,
mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of stress in there. So it is nice to have support of your family but they enjoy it too. You know how K-State fans are.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So, everybody has a good time.
Did DJ ask a lot of advice from you since you'd gone through kind of the same step process, or was he more like, "Hey, I want to do it on my own from the standpoint of experience it myself"?
No, DJ, you know, once he got into college, especially, and he knew that's where he was going to specialize. We spent a lot of time up here at the high school on the mm-hmm. football field, you know, working on his drop and his technique, and the thing about it is, Sean Snyder, everybody mm-hmm. knows Sean, who mm-hmm. you know, he back then was coaching all the special teams and stuff, and he kind of had different philosophies on how to do it than how I did it, you know. So he would try to kind of teach those guys a little bit differently than what I did, which is something that always kind of bothered me, because to me, every kid that kicks, there's things about them that are just enough different to where you got to kind of work with their abilities and their talents and not try to just totally change them into doing it. This is the way you're going to do it. So sometimes Sean and I didn't see eye to eye on some of that, but DJ was a good listener. And so, yeah, we worked a lot on it together.
Did you ever take a huge hit, whether it be college or pro? What was the hardest hit you ever took?
Oh, it definitely wouldn't have been in college, but in the pros, probably a couple times a year, you know, you'd get a return man, you know, that would break one for 25, 30 yards, and you know, you think you got a beat on him, and you're watching him, and you're trying to push him to the sideline, and he goes to cut back, and right when you turn, there's a, you know, a 250-pound linebacker running full blast, and he just cleans your clock. And I mean, I've done a complete backflip. I've been hit so hard, and you know, you sit out there and you wonder which sideline you're supposed to go to, and but yeah, those guys, you know, if they can put a punter or kicker out in the NFL, there's really not a backup
right
on the team to take his place. So if they can knock out a kicker or a punter, you know, that's a big deal. I mean, I know it's hard to imagine with all the things you see going on, the deflate gate and all this kind of stuff, but you know, we used to give out awards for the big big hits in the meetings and for knocking a guy out or whatever. I mean, it just was part of our meetings on Monday mornings. I mean, everybody would come in and have a good time watching. We'd play back a hit that would knock somebody out over and over again, and everybody screaming and hollering, you know. Or if I could get my clock cleaned, you know, like I had before, they'd play that back and forth, and everybody would make fun of you too, you know, if it happened to somebody on your team. But that was part of the game back then. I mean, you tried to knock people out of the ball game.
Sure.
That was just basically part of it, you know.
What's the biggest change you've seen from when you played to now? Is it the safety where, you know, sometimes you can't touch the quarterback, you can't even go low at the knees? There's a lot of safety protocol now with concussions, trying to make the sport safer, although we just saw quarterback for the Rams who clearly looked concussed but was left in the game and then fumbled late after that. Are there some of the biggest issues or things you've seen change since you were in there?
Yeah, I think, you know, the concussion issue definitely is one of the big differences, because you know, they used to put the smelly salt in front of your nose and you go back out and play. I mean, you didn't sit on the sidelines and get evaluated very long. You were back in the ball game. So I think those precautions are good. I think, you know, protecting the quarterback like they do, I really think that's good too, because guys are getting bigger. You know, back when I played, you know, two of the biggest guys in the NFL were probably weighed around 340 pounds. Now you got guys, you know, they probably average, I don't know for sure what an offensive line is, but probably 360, 370 or more. And there's guys that are bigger, so, and they can still run. So, you know, you got to protect the guys that got their backs turned to the players sometimes when they're about to get hit. I think it's really important, because one of these days they're just going to break somebody in half if they don't. But bigger and stronger, it's just, you know, I'm sure if I went back and played again, that would be one of the biggest differences, is I think that guys are probably just stronger than they were when I played a long time ago.
Were you ever diagnosed with a concussion? And then the second part of that question is, how many concussions do you think you had where you put the smelling salts, boom, you went back out there?
Yeah, I don't know that they really diagnosed us back then with concussions. Yes, you just came off the sideline, and you know, you were dizzy, and they would give you the smelly snot, and you know, and you get back out in the ball game. So, you know, then the next day, if you were okay, you went back out to practice. I mean, you never thought anything about it. But I suppose I had, if I was just guessing back on the times, I've at least, you know, 7 or 8. So,
and the reason I ask that question is, and not to make fun of your position, but you were a punter, and you just told me you played in the league for six seasons and 7-8 concussions. Would that been would there have been few in college or them all in the pro pretty much?
Oh yeah, there would have been a few in college. Okay. I'm sure there were some in high school too.
Right.
But you know, when it would happen to me in the college level and pro level, it wouldn't be because, you know, it's a heads up play and you see the guy coming. You know, normally, you know, if you saw the guy getting ready to hit you,
you could
kind of protect yourself. But it's those plays where, you know, it's almost an illegal block in the back, or you're right when you turn and somebody just lets you have it that mm-hmm. you don't even know they're there. That's when it hurts. I mean,
yeah.
That's when you see stars, and that's when people make fun of you when they roll the film back and practice the next day, because it's a pretty vicious thing when that happens.
So if you had that many that you think you had over your career, and my point that I'm getting to is, and you were a punter, you have to sit here and go and imagine how many concussions that a linebacker has, a quarterback has, a running back, I would think, would have probably quite a few concussions. And I heard Tim Grenhardt say this one time on the radio, and of course he played with the Chiefs for quite some time, and he's a very smart guy, went to Notre Dame, very intelligent. And they say that the average lifespan, you lose a year of your life for every year you played in the league. And Tim Grenhardt, when we were talking about, well, would you do this again? Because a lot of players, you know, Gale Sayers even come out and talked about against the National Football League, and he's a Hall of Famer, about the concussions. And some people say, well, you chose to play that sport. You knew the inherent danger, so forth and so on. Others say, no, you have to protect your assets, protect your players and their human beings and so forth. But Tim Grenhardt said, if I had to do it all over again, I would. He said, I wouldn't even hesitate. If I knew I'm losing 10 years off my life, I'm going to do it. Now, there are some other players that have said, I don't want my kids playing football. I think Kurt Warner said it. I think Drew Brees has said, I'd really have to think about it. You obviously let your kids play football. DJ went on to play. Has your thought process, once you take all that into consideration, have you thought, wow, if I've got grandchildren, do I want them playing football? Has the game changed so much where it's safer for them? Or is it, you know what I'm saying? What's your thoughts on all that with the safety protocol and the way the sport's going?
Well, you know, I loved the game of football. I would have played it. I would have played it again, even mm-hmm. with what we know today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, I love to play the game of football. I think it's really important that they're taught properly technique. You know, there for a while, you know, it got to where you would see headshots, you know, in football games, and they wouldn't throw flags, you know, and obviously they're paying attention to that. And I think all that really is good, because it protects not only the guy maybe catching the football, it protects the defensive back from hitting somebody, you know, with his head and you know, where he shouldn't be, and jamming his own neck or mm-hmm. causing his own concussion. So, you know, I think a lot of that is really good. And, you know, with my grandson, you know, if he plays football, I really don't care. You know, if he does, that's great. I think he has to love the sport that he wants to play.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't know about kids playing it year-round all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you seem like there's more injuries in high school than there ever used to be, you know, whether it's women or whether it's the men,
mm-hmm.
you know, because, and I think a lot of that is because they're, you know, they're practicing, they're running, they're doing all this all summer long from the time they're 8 or 9 years old,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, we had summers off, you
yeah.
know, we would work, we'd play some pickup games, you know, and do things like that. We had jobs, and then when school rolled around, it was time to start practicing again. So I would have loved having the opportunity to play sports on the weekend through the summer, but I think that the old way that we used to do it
mm-hmm.
just gave kids a break and a chance to be kids.
Yeah, maybe a blessing in disguise.
Yeah,
based
I
on,
think so.
On when you played the game. You know, you sit now, they've got contact football, like you said, 7, 8, 9 years old. You know, you got tackle football. My son's probably going to play tackle football the first time next year, and he'll only be a fifth grader. And I sit here as a parent going, well, I like football, and I enjoyed football, and I enjoy watching him play, and I usually help coach. At the same time, I sit there and go, okay, when I was in school, we didn't have fifth, fourth grade contact football. We had junior high, 7th grade, 8th grade, and then 4 years of high school. So you had 6 years, and that's not counting if you play college or pro. That's 6 years of contact, depending on the position that you're in. That's quite a bit. And now if you add in a 6th grade year, a 5th grade year, some cases all the way down to 2nd grade or 1st grade, that's a lot of wear and tear on a body and a lot of physical contact, whether you play it year-round or just seasonally that many years.
Yeah, and, you know, you think, well, they're only, you know, in second grade or fifth grade or whatever, you know, they're not big enough to really cause a lot of damage to the other person. And that might be true, but, you know, they're still the same age playing against each other, whether you're 10 years old or whether you're 15 years old or whether you're 18 years old, you know, and you're out there, you know, jarring your body and banging your head around. So, you know, if your kids love the game and they want to play it, then I think that's great. You know, when I see parents that look like they're playing the game for their kid when he's out there, and the kid, you could tell he doesn't really want to be out there, you know, or I've watched it before where a kid will lay out there and he thinks, you know, is he hurt? He's crying, he's screaming, then he gets up finally and he's okay, you know. It's just hard to tell with those young kids. If they really want to be out there, I think it's fine. But if they don't, if they're just doing it from pressure from their parents or their other kids or friends or whatever, I don't think that's such a good thing.
Back to your playing days. Scott Folig is with us here on the Sports Ticket. What was the best punt you ever had? What's the one that stands out to you?
Oh, gosh. You know, probably one of the best games that stand out to me, and not necessarily just one punt, but it was a game against the New Orleans Saints where we went into triple overtime, and I probably had six punts in that overtime, and four of them were out of the end zone, and they were all 50-plus yard punts, and we end up winning the game with a 51-yard field goal in the playoffs. So, I mean, it's not necessarily any one punt that really stands out in my mind, but it's more of what maybe happened in the course of a game to help win that ball game.
Most feared player that you ever heard of or saw in person?
Well, there was, you know, there were some great players back then. Of course, Dion is one of the best. Roger Craig was always amazing to watch him run, and Barry Sanders. You know, those two guys, when they were just so amazing. The high knee lifts running through the offensive line and just running guys over, high-stepping over guys. I mean, they were amazing to watch those guys play football. So those three are probably three of the best guys that I ever watched play.
What about defensively? You know, Lawrence Taylor here. There are a lot of quarterbacks here, Lawrence Taylor, some fair Derek Thomas, but then there's the guys back in the day too. I mean, who's the meanest, maybe dirtiest player that your teammates told you about, you heard, or you saw in person on the sideline, or even witnessed while you're out there ready to punt?
Oh, gosh.
Guessing there were some nasty guys.
Well, there were some nasty guys. Sometimes your teammates were some of the nastiest guys that you got to know. But
especially in the locker room, probably.
You know, some of those guys, you know, they don't. Some of them don't even have a big name in the game of football, but they're the ones that play nasty just so that they can compete with some of the better guys, you know. But I don't know. You know, you named some good ones with Lawrence Taylor. You know, Jesse Tuggle was a linebacker in Atlanta that we had. Of course, he wasn't known as a mean guy, but he was a great, great defensive player. But I don't know. Top of my head, I can't even think of anybody right now.
Yeah. Okay, so now you have a nephew that's baseball. So there's some genetic code here. You know, your son played college football. You played college and pro. You got a nephew that's going to play Oakland A's. He's in the A's organization. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Dustin Hurlbut, that's my sister Sherry's son. He's a pitcher, and he's doing a great job. He's home right now from break since the season's over with, and he'll be returning, I think, in March is when they start back up with their spring training. But he's a right-handed pitcher. Right now he's up to 95-mile-an-hour fastball. He's got a good changeup. He's real consistent. I think they really like him. He's a big kid, you know, about 6'4", 210 maybe right now. So, you know, he can get bigger, and he loves what he's doing. So he's working hard. So, I'm expecting great things out of him.
Were your parents athletic?
Yeah, my dad was a good athlete. He played football and basketball, and I think he went to McPherson. And played some basketball at McPherson. My mom, not so much, but you know, she competed in high school. With whatever they had. I think they had track back then. That was something that she would do. But I don't know. really where it came from. You know, even though I was a decent athlete, I really didn't have a lot of speed. Mm-hmm. So that was probably one of the things that probably more than anything kept me from playing another position, mm-hmm. you know, at college.
Right.
I could hit and I could tackle and I could do all of that, but guys were just a little bit faster than me.
What advice would you give to a young person that plays the game of football that might aspire to get to where you were? What advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, just never give up. I mean, you know, you got to work hard. You get up early. And, you know, lots of times you're working by yourself, trying to keep yourself in shape, you know. And it's just, you know, my dream was to play. I can remember telling myself if I could just get one in 1 year, you know, mm-hmm. or get one opportunity to play in one game. And, you know, and every time I would reach that goal or that opportunity, well, then you just, of course, you want a little bit more, and I would work a little bit harder. And I remember coming back to Beloit one time, and I'm running on the track, and it was my third year trying to make it. I finally made it my third year of trying. And the teacher came up to me and said, well, if you don't make it, you just, well, go try something else, you know, do something different mm-hmm. this time. And I'm, you know, and that just kind of encouraged me to work harder and make up my mind that I was going to do it, because I was competing against those guys in training camp, and there mm-hmm. was no reason I couldn't be playing. So mm-hmm. it was a matter of getting at the right place at the right time and getting my foot in the door. And I just, you know, believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm. Do you stay in touch with any of your former teammates or coaches?
Yeah, there's a few guys I talk to, like my long snapper, some of the field goal kickers. Mm-hmm. Steve Willis, an old college buddy, he was a field goal kicker at K-State. Now his son's a starting quarterback at KU.
That's
so,
right.
I know it's hard for me to say this, but I've been pretty excited watching KU football this year, watching Ryan Willis play quarterback. You know, I don't watch the whole game. I just watch the offensive series to see how he's doing.
You just picture him in purple and white
yeah,
and black.
Yeah, but, mm-hmm. you know. And then, you know, Atlanta does a pretty good job of having reunions every year. Mm-hmm. So I try to make it down there every two or three years and catch up with everybody that I haven't seen in a while. Cincinnati, not so much. It seems like their reunions are during the summer, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm busy mm-hmm. with harvest and all that kind of stuff. So Atlanta's probably, you know, keep in touch with guys with Atlanta in the front office. And there's not a lot of people left in the front office
right.
anymore. Since I played, but there's still a couple secretaries, and it's always nice to see them.
So are you able to call up Atlanta and say, hey, I'm going to be coming down, hook me up with some seats?
Yeah. You know, I could do that for any home game. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's options, you know, to through the NFL Players Association alumni, you know, that you could call in, and if you call early enough, you know, you get tickets to about any game if you happen to be in that city.
Mm-hmm. What about the pension? Like, how long did you have to be in the league in order to qualify for the pension fund with the National Football League?
Well, when I was playing, you had to play 4 years to qualify.
Okay.
And it's improved a little bit over the years. You know, there's been more money pumped into it. Mm-hmm. And so it's improved some of what the pension will be for guys that played back when I played. And, of course, the guys previous before me, you know, they're getting paid a little bit more now, too. You know, then there's a little severance package, depending on how many years you play, how mm-hmm. much money you get out of that. But, you know, it's a lot better for the guys playing now than it was when I was playing. But the one I get's a lot better than the one mm-hmm. that the guys played 15 years before I was there too. So,
When you see these huge contracts, I mean, I'm talking player contracts, but not only that, the TV deals. I mean, and we know that, what is it, Roger Goodell makes $40 million as salary. Do you sit there as a former player, and as you just acknowledged, I know guys before me allowed me to play football and probably went through worse things I did safety-wise. I know I did some things that got concussions more so, not as safe when I played for the next generation of players. It'll continue and continue. But there's so much money in the sport now. I mean, it's the most popular sport, well, obviously in America, if not across the world. They're playing games in London and all over the place. Do you sit there and sit back, and not for you selfishly saying, well, yeah, I want more in my pension fund or whatever the case may be, but do you sit here and go, look at all these guys that have had problems health-wise ever since they quit playing. And I see all these guys getting, you know, $20 million signing bonuses. And they're not guaranteed contracts, I know that, but still, they get the big chunk up front. And you see the owners making money hand over fist. TV contracts keep getting bigger and bigger. And you've got a commissioner making, as I said, reportedly $40 million a year. Does that bother you? Does that bug you as a former player?
Oh, I don't know that it does. I mean, you know, it's... If I was playing now, I'd be all for me getting as much out of it as I could get out of it, just like they do. I mean, you know, you got to be honest with yourself. Mm-hmm. But
do you think more money should go in towards the pension?
Well, I don't think there's any reason it shouldn't, because especially back, you know, 50 years ago, you know, some of those guys are getting, you know, $300 a month in mm-hmm. pension payments, which is ridiculous, mm-hmm. really, when you think about it. You know, and it's like I say, it's better for my era, but still it's not unbelievable like you would think it would be, considering all the money that they are getting now and mm-hmm. what they're getting off the TV deals. So whenever they make those improvements, and you know, they have, you know, now there's places you can go and have, you know, your brain looked at and all these studies, make sure that you don't have, you know, the disease from all the concussions, and mm-hmm. so there are some health things that you can go do for free now, and at different places around the country that we get to take advantage of. But, you know, I don't know if it bothers me so much in the NFL as far as the money that's being made as it does more in college, when you see what mm-hmm. these coaches, you know, get paid, what they get bought out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, their contracts when they buy them out, and then tuition keeps going up for the students who are trying to get an education, because that's really what college is supposed to be about. Mm-hmm. And you know that has a tremendous effect on the tuition when they're paying a coach $7, $8 million a year and buying mm-hmm. them out for $15 million or whatever it might be. So, you know, that almost upsets me more than what the football players are making that are playing the NFL, because, you know what, it's their time to go out and play, and that's what the going price is right now. So if I was playing, I'd be probably right in there with them.
Absolutely. Final question for you. Scott Folhage is our guest today. Played in the National Football League for the Bengals and the Falcons, a six-year NFL career, four-year starter at Kansas State University, and played, of course, at Beloit High School. And he's our guest here today on The Sports Ticket, brought to you by Crossroads Bar and Grill in Downs. Final question for you, and this might be tough. That's why I leave it for the very last. The best for last, as they say. What would you consider the most rewarding moment of your career? And it could be high school, college, or pro. When I ask that question, what's the first thing that pops in your mind? And while I buy you a little bit of time, because I know you probably need a little bit because you've had, you know, a great career, for me, I think about all the things that I competed in sports and so forth and so on. And for me, my most rewarding moment had nothing to do with meddling at state in tennis. It had nothing to do with being all-league player in basketball, whatever it might be, or whether or not we won 20 games a season and lost 20. For me, the most rewarding moment for me was when I first qualified for state as a freshman for tennis, and I got blitzed and crushed at state when I made it. But it was unexpected, and I was on cloud nine, and you got all these, you know, attaboy, wow, way to go, a freshman making state, that's awesome. And then coming home and being able to share that with all my family and my grandparents, who didn't know jack about tennis, were so proud of me. And for me, that was the most, probably one of the most, if not the most rewarding moment of my sports career. And I didn't play a lot in college, and I definitely didn't play in the pro. What about for you?
Well, I mean, one thing that always sticks in my mind is just the first time that I was able to call, you know, Cindy up and say, you know, hey, you know, I made it.
Yes.
You know, because the dream of mine was, you know, I thought I could always do it. And then it took so long to finally 3 years. And then finally, you know, I was going to get to kick in a real football game, you know, not a preseason game, but a real season. You know, so that always still sticks in my mind. But probably the greatest thing about playing in the National Football League that gets you every single game is when you're standing on the sidelines before the game with 70,000 people, and they get ready for the national anthem, and you've got a country western singer, you've got some military brass or some military officer or somebody that's singing the national anthem, mm-hmm. and everybody is is so patriotic at that moment, and mm-hmm. it just sends chills down your body, mm-hmm. you know, when you're standing there on the sidelines of a football game, getting ready to play in the National Football League, and they're singing the national anthem, and you're in America, it just makes you feel really good. Mm. So, I mean, just that's the one thing that I always think about is right before the game starts.
Mm. Great answer. Great answer. Scott Fullegg, our guest today on the Sports Ticket. Hey, Scott, appreciate the time. I know we kept you a while.